Are you ready? Our last week together. It's very sad, isn't it? Because the closer we get to the end, the closer it is to the final exam. Well, it'll almost be over. It's like a Band-Aid, you know? You have to rip it off really fast. All right. On we go. We'll call the Aryan period. And what do I mean by the Aryan period? I'm using the word Aryan very loosely to mean not necessarily everybody who believed the same thing as Arius, okay, but those who did not subscribe to the Nicene Creed, those who were against the Creed of Nicaea. The people who accepted Nicaea, the Creed of Nicaea, they called everyone else Aryan, you know. They said, well, I don't know, I don't agree with that homoousius word. Oh, you're an Arian. You love Arius, you know. So they called them Arians, and they would say, we're not Arians. They did not accept that name. But that's the name that the Nicene people gave them, okay? All right, now, just want to remind you kind of where we left off. I think the last thing I talked about was the death of Arius, right? And how he went to the bathroom and never came back. I told you about that, right? Well, remember that I told you that Constantine exiled Athanasius of Alexandria. Athanasius was bishop of Alexandria because he would not allow Arius back into communion in the Alexandrian church. That's why they had to try it over in Constantinople. But then he died before it happened. But Athanasius had been exiled, okay, to Trier, which is in Gaul. And he's out of the picture, okay? Eusebius of Nicomedia becomes a very important figure during this period. I told you about him. He's kind of like the leader of the anti-Nicene party. Anyone who doesn't like Nicaea, Eusebius of Nicomedia, he's kind of like the guy that you look up to. All right? Well, he gets into Constantine's good graces, and he and Constantine become like this. They're buddy-buddy. Okay? And in fact, when Constantine dies, he gets baptized on his deathbed. You know, I told you how he waited until he was going to die before he got baptized. Who baptized him? Eusebius of Nicomedia. Okay? That was in 337. And Constantine's eulogy was given by Eusebius of Caesarea. That's the guy who wrote your church history. Okay? So Constantine is now dead. What's going to change as a result of that? Well, his successor was his son, Constantius II. He had a bunch of sons who kind of had a fight with each other. Constantius will be the main ruler in the east. He does have a brother named Constans who will be ruling in the west. Put his name down. I'll refer to Constans and more. So Constantius II is the emperor in the east and Constans in the west. And they kind of have an uneasy little relationship. Okay? Now, here's the interesting thing about these two men. Constantius II adheres to a non-Nicene Christology. Okay? Many people called him an Arian. He liked Eusebius of Nicomedia, and he liked his theology, and he went with that. He's a Christian, just like his dad was. Okay? Constans, on the other hand, he liked the Nicene Creed, and he agreed with Nicaea. Okay? So he tended to favor those who were of the Nicene party. Now, this is going to cause trouble between the two brothers, as you might guess. Now, the custom was, when an emperor died, everybody that was exiled is allowed to come home. So Constantius agreed to allow Athanasius return to Alexandria and take his bishopric back over, and he's now Bishop of Alexandria again. He doesn't like Athanasius because he doesn't agree with his theology, but, you know, it was a custom to allow exiles to return. So he allowed him to return. All right. Athanasius, by the way, did not go directly back to Alexandria. He made a political tour of the eastern Mediterranean, went through the Danube regions, Asia Minor, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine. He went through all those territories in order to rally support for Nicaea. All the supporters of Nicaea, okay, he was trying to help. And many of them had been exiled and were now allowed to return to their positions because that's what was happening at this point. And he used his clout to try to get them back onto their, into their bishoprics, and it happened. However, violence dogged his steps because both sides had organized popular support in the cities, and they were very ready to use angry mobs to expel churchmen that they didn't like, okay, or to get people that they did like into positions of power. And so the result was that in several cities, they were like on the verge of civil war. A bunch of people supported the Nicene Party, and a bunch of people supported the non-Nicene Party. Okay? And so there was a lot of trouble, and things are just ready to boil over. Okay? When, in fact, when Athanasius went to Constantinople, he intervened to try to get the Nicene supporter, Paul, a guy named Paul, installed as the bishop. And he did succeed in doing this in an atmosphere of violence, I should say. Okay? But after he left, Constantius came into the city and he booted Paul and he installed Eusebius of Nicomedia as the bishop of Constantinople. This is very important because now Eusebius of Nicomedia has an extremely powerful post. Okay? Constantinople is the most important city in the East. Alexandria probably next, and Antioch probably next after that. Whoever holds the positions in Constantinople, Antioch, and Alexandria, they're running things in the Eastern Empire. In the West, Rome would be very important. Carthage would be very important. Places like that. Okay? All right. Well, several months after this, a council of bishops met in Antioch to declare that in addition to the older charges proved against Athanasius, there were a bunch of new atrocities that he had committed, and they wanted him removed. Now, as you might guess, these are all anti-Nicene bishops who assembled at this council to boot out Athanasius. And these were the charges: inciting mobs to assault and murder, handing over his opponents to be imprisoned and executed by the prefect of Egypt, financing a campaign of violence by misappropriating charitable funds. In other words, he used funds that were donated to the church in order to have these people killed and things like that. Those were the charges that were brought up against him, and the council ordered him deposed. Constantius couldn't have been happier, and he endorsed the decision. And so Athanasius, in an attempt to save himself, convened a council of his own with 80 Egyptian bishops there. And they cleared him of all charges, said he was completely innocent, and said that his accusers were heretics, okay, and that their motivation for going against him was because they hated Jesus Christ. Okay? And then he induced the famous monk Antony to come from the desert to testify that Athanasius was a man of God and that Arianism was from Satan. But it didn't help him because the leaders of the Eastern Church met yet again and they upheld that decision, and Constantius was there this time at this meeting, and they convicted Athanasius of violence and mayhem, and they ordered him deposed. And so he was deposed. He will be back. To replace him, they selected a guy named Gregory, who was against the Nicene Creed, just who they wanted. And so this Gregory becomes the new bishop of Alexandria. They also replaced the prefect of Egypt. There was a, this is just like a secular guy. There was a prefect of Egypt that was like in cahoots with Athanasius, and he had helped execute people for Athanasius. Well, they got rid of him too, and they replaced him with a guy that they liked. Okay? Then this new prefect has got to go arrest Athanasius, because Athanasius hasn't left. Okay? This new prefect has to go and arrest him. And as the story goes, he and a bunch of troops went to arrest him where he was. He was at a church. Okay? He lived in this church. But he was warned ahead of time that they were coming, and so he fled. I guess as a result of his flight, there was a bunch of riots in the city. a bunch of arson, buildings were burnt down, okay? In other words, there were supporters of Athanasius who were causing the riot because they didn't agree with his being deposed. And then the violence intensified when they escorted the new bishop, Gregory, into the city. And people burnt down one of the churches. There were people who were killed on both sides or injured. And fighting even broke out on Easter Sunday in one of the churches. But finally, after several weeks, they finally got the mobs that were supporting Athanasius suppressed, at least for the time being. And Alexandria was now under Gregory's control. At this point, if Athanasius had been captured, they probably would have executed him. But he got away. All right? And he fled to Rome in the Western Empire, where he knew Constans would protect him. Now, I just want to make it clear here that in Alexandria and many other large cities, huge groups of militant fighters could be mobilized by either side. And this will happen time and time again. Both sides make frequent use of these sorts of mobs whenever they don't get their way. Okay? So the riots in Alexandria and elsewhere make it clear that the bishops didn't necessarily speak for the people. They just got a bunch of guys, hired a bunch of guys to get things whipped up. Okay? And that got people going, and then they start burning down buildings and killing people and stuff like that. The reason, if the people in charge, the government in charge, you know, wants law and order in the city, they're going to have to succumb to the wishes of the people. So whoever can make a bigger stink, that's going to get things done. All right? That makes sense? But as you might guess, violence is just going to keep on increasing in these cities as a result. In 341, there were two councils held in Antioch that year to try and come up with an alternative to the Nicene Creed. This would be for the anti-Nicene party. Okay? They're trying to come up with some kind of good creed that can replace Nicaea. They don't like Homoousius. They want something better. They wrote up four different ones because it was hard to get them to agree on it. Okay, but they finally wrote down this fourth creed. And I'm going to read you part of it because it's kind of interesting. What is interesting about it is they distanced themselves from Arius. They want to distance themselves from Arius, but they also want to distance themselves from the Nicene Creed. So trying to find some kind of middle ground where they won't be called Arians, although they still will be, but yet they don't have to accept Nicaea. Okay? So they say things like, we believe in one God, the Father Almighty, creator and maker of all things, and so on and so forth. Then it says, and in this only begotten Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, who before all ages was begotten from the Father. That's an interesting statement. They're saying that he was begotten from the Father. Okay? They're using the word begotten in a way that Athanasius would hate. Okay? Because it's not eternal generation here. Okay? They're using the word begotten as, you know, he had a beginning of existence. Okay? But it happened before all the ages, like in the recesses of ancient time, and they're not going to get any more specific than that. Now here's how they get Arius out of it. At the end they say, those who say that the Son was from nothing or from other substances and not from God, and there was a time when he was not, the Catholic Church regards as aliens. Okay. Now, what's important about this is that, okay, Arius said that the Son was created out of nothing. They are rejecting that idea. They're rejecting the idea that he has life in himself apart from God. I really don't know who. That doesn't really go with Arius, but I'm not sure who they're trying to eliminate there. And then when they say, people who say there was a time when he was not, Arius said that. Now here's how they did it. And this is actually Eusebius of Caesarea's idea. That if you say he was begotten before the ages, that means you're saying he was begotten before time existed. Okay? So then they get to reject the idea that you can't say there was a time when he didn't exist because he was brought into existence before time. All right, so that it allows for there to be a beginning of the Son, but you don't have to say it was in time. Okay, so actually it's a compromise position somewhere in between Nicaea and true Arianism. And it is said that the bishops at this council said, when they were accused of being Arians, they said, how, being bishops, can we follow a presbyter? Okay? Meaning, we don't follow Arius. All right? But this creed will not be generally accepted by, well, it won't be accepted by the West. That's for sure. And even not everyone in the East likes it either. Okay? But they're trying to formulate an alternative creed. And at Antioch in 341 is the first time they really tried to do that. In their statements, they wanted to come up with something without using homoousios. So they deliberately did not have homoousios in it. All right, well then, Eusebius of Nicomedia dies. This is in 342. Now that really woke Constantius up, because that was his biggest ally. And he was off in the east fighting the Persians, the Sassanids. And when he found out that Eusebius of Nicomedia died, he knew he had to do something about it because Eusebius held the, I'm saying of Nicomedia, but he's actually the bishop of Constantinople. All right? That's like the most important city to be in charge of in the east. All right? So everything's changed now. Who's going to take his spot? The members of the Nicene party who were in exile were just wild with excitement over the chance to try and get one of their guys in at Constantinople, and the guy that they had tried to get in before, Paul, okay, they supported him, and they tried yet again. So Paul's supporters in the city assured him that if he came back, he would be welcomed by enormous crowds, he'd have no problem, and maybe because he was emboldened by Athanasius, he also had the consent of Constantius's brother in the west, to go do it, so he went to Constantinople. It was unauthorized, though. Constantius did not approve this. And as promised, he was greeted with large throngs of supporters, some of them quite militant, and he was installed as the metropolitan bishop. But his opponents in the city were also quite active, and they had elected a more, well, a kind of a moderate non-Nicene man, Macedonius, as their bishop, and they also mobilized in the streets for action. Well, when Constantius heard about how Paul had been installed, he was in Antioch, by the way, on the border in the east. They were there for the winter, the army was, and he wasn't fighting at this particular moment. So he was all upset by Paul's presumption that he could just waltz in there and take Constantinople. So he dispatched one of his top generals there to Constantinople by boat, with a small company of troops on board. The guy's name was Hermogenes. And Hermogenes was told that when he got there, he was supposed to evict Paul from the cathedral, arrest him, and hold him until the emperor returned from his spring campaign. Well, when the general entered the city, he found it in total chaos, and he knew it was even dangerous for him and his troops. Many people actually had already been killed in the streets, so it was just a mess. Parts of the city were on fire. So he decided to rest his troops for the night, and the next day he was going to figure out how he's going to arrest Paul. But at the height of the violence, the mob found his house where he was staying and set it on fire, and then they seized the general and his troops. They pulled them out into the street, and they beat them to death. So that plan didn't work out for Constantius. So he could scarcely contain himself now. He was so mad. He decided, well, I'm going to have to go there myself. So he came to Constantinople with a very large body of soldiers. And he went right in, and he arrested Paul. No doubt there were more deaths and injuries along the way. But Constantius held himself back from executing Paul. He really wanted to kill him, but he didn't, because he knew if he did, well, you can't kill a bishop. You know what the people are going to react like? Okay, you can't do that. So instead, he wasn't going to kill him or any of his supporters, but he could punish them. So the way he did it was he punished the whole city. He reduced the subsidy of grain, free grain, that was supposed to go to the city to help the poor, and many Christians there were poor. He reduced it by one half, hoping that the residents of the city would blame Paul and his supporters for this occurrence. Then he had the bishops install the other guy, Macedonius, as the bishop of the city. And he put Paul in chains, put him on a ship, and sent him away. All right. And Paul went to Trier, where he was looking for Constans. And he met up with the other emperor in the west, Constans. Now, Constans asked for Athanasius to come and attend him there, because he was there in exile. And then Constans wrote to his brother, Constantius, a number of very threatening letters, okay, insisting that his brother send a delegation of Eastern bishops to Trier to explain why such good men as Athanasius and Paul had been deposed and exiled, and they better defend themselves and their beliefs. So Constantius couldn't do anything but accede to his brother's requests, because he wasn't really in any position to fight a war with Constans when he was fighting with the Persians. You know, you got a one enemy at a time here. So he did send an Eastern delegation of bishops over to Constans. And four bishops got there. This is late in 342. And they bore with them copies of the creed that they had signed at Antioch, saying, here is what we believe. Isn't this great? It's nice, huh? Trying to convince them that even though they didn't use the term homoousios, it still was very correct, okay? Because they said things against Arius in it. They denounced his teachings. So, what do you think? Can you accept this? And Athanasius and Paul and Constans said, no, we don't like it. We want homoousios in there. So they wouldn't accept the document. They rejected it. So there was no deal made between the two parties. And by the way, Marcellus, who was a friend of Athanasius, he was like almost right out Sabellian, okay, a modalist. He would say things like, there's only one hypostasis. Not just that there's one ousia, one substance or one being, but there's only one hypostasis, one person, okay, Father, Son, and Spirit. And Athanasius for a while did kind of seem to accept that too. But they really, in the East, they really hated Marcellus because they thought he was the most extreme member of the Nicene party. Well, he was there too at Trier. He hung out with Paul and Athanasius. Anyway, they didn't accept the delegation's deal. And a few months later, Constans sends his brother another message insisting that a general council of Eastern and Western bishops be held. They're going to meet at Certica, just on the west side of the border between the East and West Empire. And all the bishops that they could get to come were going to come there. They were going to figure everything out and settle this once and for all. It was Constans' idea. All right. Now, Constantius understood that this council is basically going to be controlled by his brother, but he didn't refuse because he wasn't in a strong enough position to refuse. However, what he could do was, and this is what he did, he sent a relatively small number of bishops to go to the council. If they're going to dominate anyway, the Western bishops, let them dominate. We just won't send as many of our guys as we could. And then the ones who didn't go can still say, I wasn't there. You know, I'm not accepting this. So he only sent a handful of bishops. All right. So Constans convenes this council at Certica, tries to restore unity to the church, and it was a huge fiasco. They started fighting like cats and dogs. The Eastern bishops stand up and walk out. And they're like, we don't want to have anything to do with this, and they leave. And the Western bishops are, fine, we're going to write up a creed of our own. And the Eastern bishops are like, we are too. And so it didn't work. And both the Western and the Eastern bishops get together separately, and they come up with their own creeds. Okay? The Eastern creed is basically the same thing as you already saw, the creed that they brought to show them. It wasn't much different. Okay, except there were additional elements that were directly addressed to Marcellus and how he was wrong. Okay, but it basically was the same creed that they had done at Antioch. The West also released a creed, and they said it was basically drawn up as an attack on Arianism, but they were accusing the Eastern bishops of being Arians. Okay, and it named also in their statement 11 bishops that were to be excommunicated and deposed in the East, that they didn't like, because they were too Arian. All right? And It declared that nobody should communicate with them because they are from the devil. Interestingly, in this statement, they also assert that God is just one hypostasis, which is particularly upsetting to the Eastern bishops because that's as extreme as you can get. It borders on modalism. Okay? So this Council of Sirdica didn't really work out. All right? At that point, the Westerners sent a nicer letter to Constantius, requesting that he separate church and state. Basically, they're asking him, why don't you back off, refrain from surveillance of religion? It's not really your jurisdiction. You shouldn't be getting involved in religion. Why don't you back out of it and let the bishops take care of it? All right. Now, I just want to, even though it sounds like a plea for a separation of church and state, it's really not. Because neither side in the controversy really believed in the separation of church and state. It's just that they wanted Constantius out of it because he was supporting their enemies. And so how do you get him out of it? They're trying to talk him out of it, right? Stay out of religion. Okay? They're more than happy to have Constans on their side. Okay? They just didn't want Constantius on the other guy's side. All right? So they don't really want separation of church and state. They just want Constantius out of the picture. Well, of course, he doesn't listen. Then in 344, interesting series of events occurs. You could almost call it funny if it weren't so terrible what happened. Okay, this happened in Antioch. This is where Constantius' military is, their headquarters are, in their campaigns against the Sassanians. It's also kind of a center for non-Nicene religious power. Anyway, after this huge fiasco at Sirdica, the Western bishops sent a delegation to the city of Antioch to deliver their message to Constantius. This is that letter I was just telling you about, the mild letter request for him to stay out of matters of religion. Okay? They also asked that he consider readmitting some of their exiles, the Nicene exiles, back to their sees. Well, two bishops were in this delegation, and they carried the letters to the palace where Constantius was, and they paid their respects to the emperor. Then they went back to the inn where they were staying. Well, the bishop of Antioch, who was very anti-Nicene, okay, a guy by the name of Stephanus, he had been singled out for abuse by the Western bishops. He actually was one of the bishops that they wanted excommunicated. So, he's really mad at them. He's still upset about it, and he wants to sabotage their mission. So he sent two of his presbyters in disguise to a local brothel. And their instructions were to hire a prostitute to spend the night with the delegation's senior member, a guy by the name of Euphrates, so one of the bishops who came from the West. Asked them to hire a prostitute to go and visit him and spend the night with him. Okay? And then they were going to jump in there in the morning and, well, they don't have cameras, but they were going to, oh, we caught ya! In bed with a prostitute, and was going to humiliate him, right? So that was the plan. So they hire the prostitute, and she goes, but they didn't tell her that she's been sleeping with a bishop. She had no idea. So she goes into the room, and there's this old guy sleeping in his bed, and he's got all his bishop's regalia on the chair or whatever, and she realizes what they're asking her to do, and she doesn't want to do it. But she knows that if she just leaves, Stephanus is really going to go after her and she'll be in trouble. So she decides to scream at the top of her lungs. She screams and all these people start running into the room from the end. Well, they thought something was going on. And she screamed to get a whole bunch of people in there. And she tells them the whole story, what happened. But because they're all now feeling sorry for her, she's got a lot of supporters who are going to protect her from the bishop. So she doesn't get hurt or anything like that. Well, when people found out that the bishop, Stephanus, had actually planned this whole thing, there was a big to-do about it, as you might guess. Okay? And an angry mob formed at dawn right outside the doors of his cathedral, demanding that he explain himself or face being deposed. So Constantius, who was in town, was forced to send his officials over there to placate the crowd. And then there was an investigation and a little trial, okay? And it was found that Stephanus was in fact guilty of this, and he was excommunicated and deposed, okay? By a lot of his own guys, but, you know, you got to get rid of those people, right? It was a big fiasco. Stephanus was replaced by a moderate, and they tried to make nice overtones to the West, saying, we're really sorry, this was not our plan, it was all Stephanus, we had nothing to do with it, so please, you know, don't get upset. All right. At the meeting where they replaced Stephanus, the members who were there wrote out a little statement of faith that they could send to the Westerners, hoping that they would be okay with this. Say, see, we believe good things here just like you do. And the statement was this: the Father and the Son are united with each other without mediation or distance. They exist inseparable, the whole of the Father embracing the Son and the whole of the Son attached and adhering to the Father and alone resting on the Father's bosom continually. Now you see what they're trying to do? They don't want to say homoousios, but they're trying to make the Father and Son as close together as possible in other language. That's not quite as rigid, you know. Hopefully the Western bishops were like, okay, all right, we think you're all right. You believe that. And they also said they wanted to compromise with them. And the West, too, actually made some conciliatory gestures toward the East. They actually, on their side, condemned one of Marcellus's more radical disciples, a guy who's very much a modalist, and you know, they deposed him, condemned and deposed him, trying to appease the East. They didn't condemn Marcellus, though, which the East really wanted. All right, but they came close to it. And they also, though, although not deposing him or condemning him, he was already deposed, not condemning him, Athanasius and some of the other Western bishops stopped hanging around Marcellus. They withdrew company from him to make the East happy. All right. So each side is trying to muzzle their own extremists and try to find some common ground. Okay? But would this produce a peaceful settlement between them? Not really. So here's what happens. In 344, probably with Constans behind it, although we don't know this for sure, Paul returns to Constantinople and tries to take over yet again. It was kind of a dare. He's going to say, okay, Constantius, you're going to come back here again and throw me out or what? So Paul goes back to the city, and he had a number of supporters there, so he installs himself as bishop, although the other bishop's still there. Okay. So Constantius is like, okay, what am I going to do now? If I go back, there's going to be another riot. Lots of people are going to die again. How do I handle this? All right. And do I want to march all the way over to Constantinople? By the time I got there, the city will be in flames. So here's what happened. A few days later, after Paul came into town and he's installed, he gets a message from the city's chief civil official, a Praetorian prefect. His name was Philippus. And he said, would you like to come visit me in the baths, the local baths? And Paul knew what that meant. It's like, oh, an invitation to bathe in the company of other well-bred men of Roman society here? He's trying to, you know, Constantius has decided he's going to try and make amends and be friends with me. Okay? He says, oh, of course, because he doesn't want to alienate the people. You know, he goes against me, the people in the city will get upset. So he's trying to make some overtures of peace here. Okay? So he's asking the prefect to have me come visit, and we're going to make amends. So Paul goes to the baths, and when he gets there, the prefect is there with an armed escort, and when he walks in, they bar the doors. And they bound Paul, gagged him, put him aboard a ship, and sent it away. Okay? Got rid of him. So he was fooled. And he met up with Constans again to complain. All right. So Constans is like, okay, I've had enough. My brother is just a jerk. He will not let this Paul guy in. And Constans was upset. Okay? So he gave Constantius an ultimatum. And it leaves little to the imagination. Here are his exact words. He says, Athanasius and Paul are here with me. From questioning them, I have discovered that they are being persecuted for the sake of their piety. Accordingly, if you undertake to restore them to their episcopal thrones, expelling those who are vainly clinging to them, I shall send the men to you. But if you were to refuse to take this action, be assured that I will come in person and restore them to the thrones which are theirs, even against your will. So this is an unmistakable threat of war here. You don't put Athanasius and Paul back on their episcopal thrones. They're calling them thrones by this time. Then I will. Okay? Now, Constantius might well have yielded to this in any case, but circumstances happened where it was much easier to do it. Gregory, who had replaced Athanasius as the Bishop of Alexandria, he died suddenly, and he left the bishopric vacant. And so now there could have been an election, okay? But if they had an election by the Egyptian bishops, chances are that they would have voted for Athanasius anyway, because he had a lot of supporters there. He had maintained contact with Egypt during his exile, writing them all kinds of letters and stuff. And it actually had worked to his advantage, because when you got a bishop in exile complaining how he's suffering and he's being persecuted and all that, and you're writing these messages to your supporters, word's going to get around that he's being mistreated, and then people are going to like him more, right? So Constantius sends a message to Athanasius and says, all right, you can go back to Alexandria. And so Athanasius gets to return to his office. But he's not fool enough to just go straight there to claim the bishop's chair, because he understood very well that Constantius had restored him because he had to, not because he wanted to. And that if anything happened between the two brothers, if the guy ever got into a war or anything, Constantius would boot him again. So he wanted to make sure that didn't happen again. So what he did was, he took another, like he did last time, a long route home, pausing in city after city to rally his supporters and collect testimonials on his behalf, solicit guarantees of protection from various imperial officials and so on before he went back to Alexandria. He even met Constantius in Antioch, and the emperor assured him that, don't worry, I'm not going to do anything, and promised him he would let him be. Okay? So it wasn't like until a year later that he actually got back to Alexandria. And when he got back, it was a triumphant return. The people just couldn't wait for him to be there. He had all kinds of supporters. He was more popular than ever. And in part, that was because of his sufferings in exile. And he had become kind of like a big figure because of this. And they went out to meet him outside the city. They brought him in. There was a big parade. People were throwing flowers. All right? And so things were good for Athanasius at this point. Paul also returned to Constantinople. And he was restored there. Well, actually, he never had it, but he was put into his see officially for the first time. And other pro-Nicene exiles were also restored to their sees. So Constantius is losing the battle here. Until something does change. Constans, his brother, is murdered by a rebel general. It just was fortuitous for Constantius. He didn't do anything. It wasn't his idea. It had nothing to do with him. But there was a rebel general in the west who tried to take over, and he killed Constans. His name was Magnentius. So Constans is dead. All right? And Constantius had to go and fight Magnentius. And it took him about 3 years, but by 353, he defeats Magnentius and now becomes the sole ruler of the Roman Empire. With Constans gone, no one in power is supporting the Nicene Party. And so Constantius now can get some things done that he's been wanting to do, but his brother wouldn't let him. Okay? But by this time, the situation is a lot more complex than just simply Nicenes and non-Nicenes. Okay? There are several different parties that have formed by the mid-350s, and they're up here on the board, and I'm going to go over them with you. Four main parties. Okay? The Homoousian party, that would be the Nicene party. Okay? The ones that accept the Nicene position that the Son is Homoousius, you know, of the same substance as the Father. Okay? Athanasius would be the most outstanding member of this party. Okay? Then you have a group that's kind of a newer group, the Homoiousians. So if you don't really look at the word closely, you might not notice the extra I. Okay? Homoousian and Homoiousian. All right? There's a difference. Homoiousius means of similar substance, not same substance. Okay? So these are people who say they have misgivings about Homoousius, but they say, well, how about a word that's similar? Homoiousius. The Son is of like substance with the Father. Okay? Similar, but not the same substance. All right? So they're trying to preserve a distinction between Father and Son here, and they feel that Homoiousius does it, okay, rather than Homoousius. All right? Then you've got on the other, you know, the furthest removed from the Homoousian party would be the Anomoians. All right? Coming from a word meaning unlike. Okay? Unlike. So they're sometimes called Neo-Arians because they're the closest to the position that Arius had. Okay? Which is, but Anomoian means that the Son is not like the Father in substance. Okay? It's completely different. You got the Father, you got the Son, they have completely different substances or beings. Okay? The Father is unbegotten, the Son is begotten. So they must be unlike each other. How can something begotten and something unbegotten have the same substance? All right? They're the most extreme. And the biggest representative from this party would be Eunomius of Cyzicus. His predecessor was a guy named Aetius, and maybe you've heard him mentioned a few times. Aetius was his teacher, but Eunomius got more attention than even Aetius did. And sometimes this party is called the Eunomian party after him. Okay. I apologize that there's so many synonyms here. So you've got the Nicenes, who are the same as the Homoousians, right? You've got these Anomoians, who are the same as the Eunomians or the Neo-Arians. You know, it's just crazy. And then, finally, you got the Homoian party. And they basically take a non-stance. They want to include everybody. So they say, why don't we just say that the Son is like the Father and leave substance out of it. Okay? Let's say the Son is like the Father and leave it at that. Can't you just accept a nice, broad, general term? It's nice and ambiguous and vague so it can include everybody. Because even the Anomoians could say, well, yeah, the Son's like the Father. He might not have the same substance, but, you know, he's similar to the Father. Okay? So it's like it's trying to be inclusive. So the Homoian party is trying to include everybody. All right? And in fact, Constantius rather likes the Homoian party. He thinks, you know, that's the best way to do it because he wants unity. And clearly, people are not going to resolve their differences because it's been several decades now and they're still not resolving their differences. So why not just come up with something general, ambiguous, that can be inclusive? Now, I should mention that from the Homoousian party's point of view, that's the Nicene party's point of view, the other three parties, Homoiousians, Anomoians, and Homoians, they're all Arians. Okay? They call them Arians. Doesn't matter. If you don't accept Homoousius, you're an Arian. All right? That's why, like in Socrates' history, he just calls them all Arians who are not on board with Nicaea. Okay? But the only ones, I guess, that you might be able to give the term Arian to would be the Anomoian party. Things are not very simple. And all these parties are working against each other. Well, some of them are allies with one another. The Homoians and the Homoiousians tend to be friends. Okay? They work together. But it's very complicated. Well, now that Constans is dead, you can get rid of Athanasius. And that's exactly what Constantius did. He sent in troops to Alexandria, and Athanasius actually fled. And he's out. Okay, but he continues to write books and treatises and sends them to his friends in Alexandria, still claiming that he's still the bishop. Okay, but a new bishop is named for Alexandria, and this guy's name is George. And George is an Anomoian. Okay? In Antioch, another Anomoian bishop was installed. Two very strongly Arian bishops are now in power in Antioch and Alexandria. Well, the next thing Constantius does is says, okay, let's try and come up with a nice creed that's going to include everybody. And he held a council, a place called Sirmium. It's nothing you need to remember, but in case you want to write down Sirmium. There's actually going to be a few councils at this place, but and they come up with a creed that can include everybody. Both Homoousius and Homoiousius are avoided, saying, oh, these are not from the Bible, we're not going to use them. And it's also agreed that the Father is greater than his Son, so the Son is subordinate to the Father. All right? But the fact that it avoided all terms, we're not going to use Homoousius, we're not going to use Homoiousius, we're not going to use the expressions of the Anomoians either. We're not going to say he's unlike. We're just going to say the Son and Father are like each other, and we're going to leave it at that. No other weird philosophical terms. The Homoousian party called it the blasphemy of Sirmium. They, of course, don't like it. All right. So even though it's trying to be inclusive, it really doesn't help. And not a whole bunch of people showed up to it, so a lot of people don't accept it. The Homoiousian party, even though it says here we don't like that term, they're still around. Okay, so Constantius tries with a number of councils to try to get this Homoian point of view across and get people to accept it, but it isn't working. Okay, it's funny, about a few couple decades later, speaking of the 350s, when most people who were against Nicaea were in power and had most of the bishoprics. Jerome, later writing about this, said, at this time, the whole world groaned, astonished to find itself Arian. So, admitting that during this period, the Arians, or the non-Nicene groups, are pretty much running the place. Well, Constantius's armies are facing difficulties in their wars with the East, and they keep meeting defeats. And he has a relative named Julian, who is kind of in charge in the West. And Julian is getting his forces ready to come and fight with Constantius because he wants to take the whole empire. But he doesn't have to do that because Constantius gets sick and is on his deathbed, and he just names Julian his successor and dies. And so Julian becomes the next emperor anyway. All right, that was in 361. And when the news of Constantius' death reached Alexandria, the Arian bishop who was installed by Constantius, he had been protected by Constantius. Now, he's only got a minority, apparently, in Alexandria that are following him, and an enraged mob comes to the church where he's at and tear him limb from limb. And that was the end of George. Okay? And the popular Athanasius now has the opportunity to come back, return to Alexandria. All right? Now, that leads us to Julian the Apostate, the conflict between paganism and Christianity. Despite all the stuff I've been telling you, paganism probably remained the religion of the majority in the empire. Until well into the 4th century, into the second half of the 4th century. So maybe we're starting to get to a time where, you know, the pagans and the Christians are getting close in number, but they had still been a majority for a long time. It's really hard to let go of old traditions. Even intellectuals, okay, still went through the motions of doing all their pagan customs because it was a tradition, okay? You don't give up those things very easily. Now, towards the last years of Constantine's reign, a few years back, there had been some discouragement of pagan cult activities, to the extent that a few temples may have been dismantled. But nothing was really done to molest the ancient ceremonies of Rome. Constantine retained the title Pontifex Maximus, for example, and he continued to honor the customs of the past. Under Constantine's sons, there had been more decisive moves against paganism. Sacrifices were forbidden under, I think, Constantius. And a number of unimportant temples were closed. But in general, paganism was still around. All right? But it's, you know, there are moves against it, and slowly people are turning away from it. Well, Julian puts a stop to that. Okay, Julian will be the last Roman emperor who is not Christian. But to be more specific, I should tell you that he was raised a Christian. He just left it. Okay? He was educated by Christian tutors growing up, but he had a very excellent knowledge of the Greek classics, all right, philosophy, because his teachers were rather liberal and they allowed him to learn about, you know, the pagan past as well. And he was very interested in theological studies. He was even baptized as a Christian and even became a reader in the church. But when he became 18, he wanted a little bit more freedom, and he wanted to know more about paganism, and he began to read a lot of other stuff, non-Christian stuff. And he came under the influence of a Neoplatonic philosopher, studied under him for a while, until, at least privately, you know, he was now pagan. He left Christianity. That's why they call him the apostate, because that refers to someone who was a Christian who turns away from it. Okay? When Constantius died and Julian became the emperor, he came out of the closet and said, by the way, I'm a pagan. Okay. Now, his accession as emperor had some immediate consequences on the church. His formal policy was to reopen and repair the pagan temples. Now, he declared toleration for all right? But he did oppose Christianity, not by force, or even argument, so much as by ridicule. He would just say jokes about it, make it look stupid. But he didn't want to get into a real fight with the Christians, because then they're going to have martyrs on their side, and they're going to say, oh, Julian's hurting us, and he's doing terrible things. So he didn't want to really go against it by force. In a number of instances, however, he had to. So, for example, there was a riot in, a few of them, in Syria and Asia Minor, and he had to bring in some troops to kind of suppress them. And then, of course, if people get killed, then the Christians are like, oh, what a horrible emperor. He killed us, our people, and blah, 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 blah. So he ran into a few of those problems. One of the things he did was he helped everybody who wasn't a Christian. He even helped the Jews, because he thought, well, that'll really annoy the Christians, won't it? Yeah, I'm going to help the Jews. So he actually told the Jews that he was going to fund the reconstruction of the Jewish temple. We're going to build your temple again. Wouldn't that be great? And the Jews are all excited. Okay? He changed his mind later, though. But it wasn't because he just changed his mind. It was because there was an earthquake, and he was very into soothsaying and oracles and all that, and he thought that it was a sign from the gods not to. And so he changed his mind because of that. But to encourage paganism, he discriminated against Christians in making appointments to high office in the civil administration and in the army. All right? And in fact, he promoted to high positions any Christians who were considered heretics, just to annoy the other Christians. All right? So if you're considered a heretic, you know, if you're a Donatist or something like that, Novatian, we're going to give you high positions in the government. Some of, you know, heretic Christians just came out of the woodwork because they wanted to to get these positions, and they did. All right. He also forbid Christians from becoming or from entering the teaching profession because he felt Christians could not adequately teach the pagan classics. And why not? Because they don't believe in them. So let's get pagans in there who really respect these pagan stories. All right? He totally reorganized paganism as well. He saw that if he modeled paganism on the Christian church, it actually would do well because he knew that they did well in the way they organized themselves. So he remodeled paganism based on the way Christianity was run. He even had a friend of his compose a catechism of pagan teaching, a work which is still extant, by the way. High priests were nominated by him, and they were basically to fulfill the same function that Christian bishops held in the cities. They would even be paid for their services, and they would organize works of charity for the poor. The standing and moral character of the pagan priest was important. Just like the Christian priests have to be of upstanding moral character, they're supposed to be, all right? So the pagan priests had to be as well. So they weren't allowed to like go to the taverns or have employment in disreputable jobs or go to the obscene shows or whatever, okay? And when you go into a pagan temple now, everyone's considered equal, just like the Christians do it. No matter if you're a dignitary or whatever, when you're inside a pagan temple, everyone is equal. He personally practiced sacrificing every day. He prayed. He consulted augurs and soothsayers all the time. And so he was really into the religion. He really seemed to believe it. Okay? Even pagans didn't quite understand why he was so gung-ho about it. They're like, okay, we're glad you like paganism, but boy, he's really into it, you know? So even they were kind of couldn't quite fathom why he was so gung-ho for it. Now, he wanted to go fight the Persians, just like Constantius had, but this time he's going to win. And he consulted diviners and soothsayers to see what he should do and everything like that. And he thought, he even claimed to be like the next Alexander. He was going to conquer all of Persia. But the campaign was very foolishly conducted without proper attention given to lines of communication between the troops. And in 363, in a desperate melee, Julian was fatally wounded by a lance in his side. And how it happened, no one really knows because we have a few different reports about it. Some reports say that it was some incompetent soldier from his own army that accidentally stabbed him. Another story is that he went crazy out in the battlefield like in a suicidal rampage and got killed because he wasn't watching out for himself. Another writer, a few years later, said that it was the responsibility of the Christians. A Christian in the army had killed him or something like that. Okay? It seems to have just been he was careless in battle and he got stabbed. But we actually don't know by which side, but he died. And with his death, the Roman emperors will be Christian again, and this pagan revival was only very short-lived. Okay? Nevertheless, his letters and religious discourses were printed and circulated widely even after his death. More than 50 years after his death, the bishop of Alexandria at the time, his name is Cyril, he felt it necessary to even write an answer to a tract that Julian had written called Against the Galileans. Julian called the Christians Galileans, just kind of as a slur. And that's the work Against the Galileans that Cyril wrote against. Okay? So for pagans, he still was held in high esteem after he died. All right. A rise in the social status of the clergy. As I said, the remainder of the Roman emperors will be Christian. The policy of the next emperors, Valentinian and Valens, they were bros. They had two different policies. Valentinian was in the West, and he basically had a policy of religious toleration. He let people be for the most part. Okay, Valens was a non-Nicene believer, and so he promoted anything against the Nicene party in the East. Okay, generally in the East, though, they tended to be that way. During this period, the social status of the clergy is being advanced even more quickly. Now, I told you about Constantine and how he had appointed bishops to very important positions. They're becoming very powerful figures, all right, even from the time of Constantine. But it's happening even more now. It's becoming less and less common, for example, for people of the lower classes to become bishops. A guy like Callistus, for example, he had been a freed slave, and he was a bishop last century. Okay, that would never happen now. It's much more common for someone of senatorial rank to become a bishop. Okay, so this has nothing to do with religion, but the higher class you are, the more likely you are to become bishop during this time period. All right? No one since Constantine raised the social status of bishops higher than Damasus of Rome. He's quite a character. And that's him there on the right, a later picture of him. Here's how he came to power. At Rome, there were two factions that broke out, like we've seen in many different places. And when a previous bishop, Liberius, died, there were two parties trying to get a bishop elected. Ursinus is a guy from the non-Nicene party, Ursinus, and Damasus was from the Nicene party. The partisanship between these two groups flared into an ugly riot. I think for 3 days there was riots in the streets, okay, over this, all right? And finally, the prefect of the city supported Damasus and helped install him as the bishop of the city and then enforced that, okay? And once Damasus was securely consecrated bishop of Rome, he had his men attack Ursinus and his remaining supporters who were seeking refuge in a nearby basilica. And it resulted in the massacre of 137 of Ursinus' supporters. Okay. Now, this didn't go over very well, and Damasus was accused of homicide. Okay. But he was rescued from this humiliation because of some rich friends that he had that obtained the emperor's personal intervention on his behalf. All right? And so he was able to remain as bishop. Now, perhaps compensating for his moral weakness, okay, he was able to do some other things that exalted the spiritual dignity of the office of the Bishop of Rome. He, of course, talked about how he was the successor to St. Peter, okay? And in fact, inherits apostolic authority from them, from the apostles, rather than anyone else. He even said things like, well, yeah, maybe the apostles came from the East, okay? But they ended up here in Rome, and this is the see of the apostles. Okay, so he's really promoting the bishopric of Rome. He did a lot of notable works for the aesthetic enrichment of city churches and liturgical enrichment. He employed a very famous calligrapher, for example, to adorn the shrines of martyrs and past bishops with all kinds of interesting epigrams that looked really beautiful. All right. He had a scholar named Jerome, I mentioned him before, begin work on a new Latin translation of the Bible. It will become eventually known as the Vulgate. Okay, I think it was finished about 405. This would be after Damasus was dead, but he started the whole thing going. There were those in Roman society, both pagan and Christian, who credited Damasus with a lot of ambition for worldly high society. He lived very opulently. Is that a word, opulently? I think so. And I told you an anecdote about him earlier where a rich aristocrat went up to him and said, make me bishop of Rome and I'll become a Christian. Because like Damasus was living really high off the hog and like, yeah, I'll be bishop of Rome. I'll be a Christian if I could be you have your job. All right. The pagan historian Ammianus narrates a story about Damasus' election at Rome with somewhat sardonic detachment. But then Contrast the high style of bishops in great cities with the frugal life of bishops in the country, showing how the bishops in the city, they live a great life. Okay? They have beautiful homes, great beautiful furniture, clothing, food. Okay, they live well. Whereas bishops in the country, they live a very frugal life. So there's a difference here between the two kinds. All right. Demas's critics called him the lady's ear tickler because he had such a great ability at charming wealthy Christian women to give money to the church. They go, the lady's ear tickler. He did as much, I think he did more than any other 4th century bishop to make it natural for the upper class families of Rome to turn to Christianity without feeling like they were doing something un-Roman or disreputable. Okay, he fuses the old Roman civic pride with Christianity. So you can be Roman and Christian at the same time. The way he adorned the martyrs' graves and stressed, you know, the founding of the church by the apostles kind of put Christianity at the forefront of Roman history. Like, this is very Roman. We're all about Rome. Okay? And we've come from bygone days in the great Roman past. So there's nothing shameful about Christianity. And along with the same idea here, titles become very important for the clergy class during this period. As early as 313, Constantine gave the title illustrious to many of the bishops. And also, he started using the word most glorious as a title for many of the bishops. And from that time forward, you'll see other ones added, like your holiness, okay, things like that. And then, of course, the word pope, which is an affectionate title meaning papa that a child might use for his father. But Christians began using it for various bishops that they liked a lot. And oh, papa, you know. But then, for some reason, by the time you get to the 6th century, which we're not even going to get to, the Bishop of Rome claims that that's his title exclusively. No one else is allowed to be called pope. And in fact, by the 9th century, there's a story about a pope from that time period whose feelings were hurt when he was addressed by the title brother. All right. Also, and if you take a look at the picture, you can see a little bit of it, insignia become important for bishops. As they acquire social rank, they also acquire the corresponding insignia. These insignia are going to continue to be used in the church for many centuries to come, all right? Long after they had any meaning as far as Roman culture, but they're from Roman culture. But then the church begins to use these insignia, and then they will stretch out into the Middle Ages, and people have forgotten Rome, but the church officials still wear this stuff. So, for example, for bishops to have this mitre, they call it, it's a folding cap that has two parts. You can't really see the two parts from a view from the front here, but you know it's this hat like that, and in the back there's another one, right? There's two. It's called a mitre. That kind of a hat, and a special woolen cloak they used to wear, called a pallium. Okay, and a staff. They'd carry a staff. These come from secular Roman civic positions, and now they're being used by bishops. The custom of kissing a bishop's hand is first attested in the 4th century, which is where we are right now. Okay, the ring won't be used, though, until the 7th century or something like that. Okay, but this all comes from the imperial court, and now the bishops are wearing this sort of clothing. All right, well, that's where we're going to end today.